Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Have you ever received a bill in the mail for medical treatment that you weren't expecting? Often these surprise bills are the result of a procedure or test being performed by a provider that is outside your insurance company's network or has been subcontracted by the in-network provider. Now there is legislation that would exclude the patient in the billing process. Joining us to talk about surprise medical bills today, Antoinette Krause is the founding director of the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Ms. Krause, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Always good to be here.
Lynn Quincy is director of the Healthcare Value Hub. Ms. Quincy, good to hear from you this morning.
Happy to be here.
And Jim Pollan was a business owner in York, and he has a story to tell about a surprise medical bill. Mr. Pollan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, have you ever received a surprise medical bill? Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Jim Pollan, I'm going to start with you. You owned a business in New York, and let's go back about 10 years in the throes of the Great Recession. Tell us what happened.
Well, my six-year-old daughter had been getting her hearing test by the school nurse, not doing well. The nurse was adamant. We kept thinking it was, bad colds. Turned out that we needed to take her to the ENT, the ear, nose, and throat specialist in York. We did. And that led to putting tubes in. That didn't solve it. That led to a CAT scan, which showed a condition that was bilateral, both ears, that was very serious, could lead to permanent hearing loss, could even become life-threatening.
So what did the ENT doc suggest or advise you to do?
Well, surgery was absolutely necessary to get in there and cut out these growths that were apparently naturally occurring in both ears. Behind the eardrums were the small three little bones we all know about for hearing, and they were attaching to those bones and eventually will dissolve them and could be even worse. He advised, however, that if it was his child, he would take them to the surgeon he learned from, which is a professor down at University of Maryland. We said, makes sense to us. That doctor did 1,000 a year. He did only a couple a year up here. So I did the natural thing, knowing enough. I said, let's make sure they're in network. That ENT staff assured me. They called. They checked with my insurance carrier. They scheduled us down in Baltimore. We went down. It's about 60 miles away. I went directly to the billing staff there to ensure that they were in network. They checked. They came back that they were. The short of it is, it turns out after three surgeries, it was decided by the insurance carrier that they were not in network down in Baltimore.
Okay, so I just want to backtrack
Yep.
for a moment. You did something that most people probably wouldn't do in that you did check ahead of time whether the surgeon was in network and you were assured that they were, or the surgeon was.
Yes, both places assured me that the Maryland operation and the facility, University of Maryland Medical Center, were all in network. And it turned out that by certain definitions, they were right. Because that carrier, turns out, had two networks. One was the official Pennsylvania network, and the second one was the Maryland-Delaware network, and it turned out that this facility and surgeon were not in the Pennsylvania network.
So, okay, now
this
makes
it sound a little stupidly complex, doesn't
but
it?
I want to make sure here, when you ask the question, as the customer, as the parent of the patient, the word you were missing was Pennsylvania network.
Correct. All I kept asking was, of the insurance company, is this in network? And everyone said, well, yeah, look right here. And they did their checking. And yes, it's in the network of this insurance carrier. Turns out that they were allowed to have slightly separate networks, one only for Pennsylvania and the other for two other states.
Well, let me ask you this. All right. Now, again,
yeah.
You asked the – and I don't want to make this sound like I'm putting this on you.
No.
But I'm asking the questions of did you think about this, that, okay, we're going to another state for this possibility that there's something different here, even though they said they were in network?
Sure. There's a reason that I checked. At the time, I had, over the years, sold health insurance for employer groups, had done enrollments, supported servicing, had run into some problems like this for my clients and their employees. So I was very concerned. That's why I was adamant at both medical practices that everybody assure us of that. However, I will own up to one thing. Being a father of a six-year-old little girl, I was far more preoccupied about this issue and the fact that they were going to go in her head behind her eardrums to save her hearing than I was about in-network. But I did ask my questions, and once I was assured, I let the topic drop.
Well, and again, getting back to what I had said earlier, the great majority of parents would be, that would be their number one concern. By the way, before we go no further, was the surgery successful, and how was your daughter?
Yes, she ended up having three surgeries from this specialist. Superb, fabulous guy, fabulous with children. Her hearing is stabilized. She has about 80% hearing in one, 90% hearing in the other. In fact, in the 1 year with 90%, they actually went back in, he did, and put a prosthetic bone, those tiny three little bones. There was a fake one in there. That was one of the three surgeries. So the condition is lifelong. We have to have her monitored every 2 years with an audiology test. That's that special sound chamber and all of that. And I have to remind her as she gets older as an adult that she needs to have that done. The only way they know to know whether or not it's getting bad again, the growths are coming back, is if the hearing changes. And then to confirm it, you spend money on a CAT scan.
Mm. All right. So... Well, it's good to hear that the surgery was successful and that your daughter is doing much better. She's 16 today, but
yes.
Right? Okay. So you get a bill in the mail. Tell me about that experience.
Well, the usual thing happened, like all of us are used to in America, we get the evidence of benefit statement, which says right on it, this is not a bill. So that comes from the insurer showing that they've been billed and that they're in the process of handling that claim. And then eventually we started getting bills. And of course, I just pretty much said, I was assured that they're all in network. Eventually, and there's another thing about me, because of having been in the business, when I realized what was going on, I went to the plan document for this insurance company, the plan that I was under, and it in there, I found what I knew would exist, is a place where as customer, I could call for the medical director for the insurance company to confer with my surgeon to determine whether or not this was truly a medically necessary. And if it was medically necessary, then the insurer was required to pay that surgeon and facilities what would be the Pennsylvania's in-network fees. As many of us would know, Pennsylvania fees in the Harrisburg-York area are not quite the same reimbursement for Baltimore, D.C. So there was what we call balance billing. The balance left me with tens of thousands of dollars to pay.
Mm. So how did you resolve this problem?
Once we had it reduced, we
And by were, the way, how much, yes. Let me interrupt for just how much money were you talking about?
Well, by the time we were done, we had it down to, with the balance billing and all of this other stuff, the net amount that we owed was in the $15,000 range. And at that point, as you alluded to about the economy, we were a self-employed business together. And we ended up filing medical bankruptcy, as far as I'm concerned, caused by the medical, but it was the whole economy dried up. And our income was driven by a healthy economy. So our self-insured status combined with this large medical billing caused me to turn to my attorney who said, let's keep a roof over your daughter's heads and file bankruptcy. So that was the outcome.
I want to turn now to Lynn Quincy. Lynn, give us the 30,000-foot view of this problem. And it is not just a Pennsylvania problem. I mean, there are a number of states that are considering legislation. And actually, on the federal level, the federal government is talking about something here. But Lynn, give us the broad view of this problem.
Well, it's a shockingly common problem that really causes a lot of hardship for consumers. There's a host of reasons why people get these unexpected medical bills where they did the right thing, they tried to go to in-network providers, and then a number of things can happen. Perhaps your hospital and your surgeon were in-network, but you didn't realize you were also going to have an assistant surgeon who ended up being out-of-network. Or perhaps it's an emergency and you don't have time to figure out who the in-network provider is and the out-of-network provider. And this is very, very common for people who have private health insurance because they tend to have restricted networks, unlike, for example, traditional Medicare. And they also have far fewer what are called balance billing protections, where like in Jim's case, he's liable for the entirety of this bill that wasn't paid by the health plan. However, there are states and as federal government, as you say, that are looking at solutions to address this.
Actually, the federal government, there's legislation on the federal level that even President Trump said a few weeks ago that he would support. Antoinette, I know that the Pennsylvania Health Access Network has been advocating legislation at the state level on this issue. What exactly are you looking to see happen?
Yeah, so I think Pennsylvania has very limited circumstances and protections for folks. So for folks like Jim, you know, there's very little to keep consumers out of the middle. So, you know, we've seen proposed legislative solutions that have moved in the Pennsylvania General Assembly and will keep pushing in the fall that would really take the consumer out of the middle. It would allow for most individuals when this happens to them, they wouldn't even know it happens because they'd be kept out of the middle. It would be resolved on the back end. If it did happen, there'd be protections and notifications that would allow individuals to know where to go to resolve the issue.
Okay, so you're saying that the consumer would not be in the middle, but how would it work? There has to be some negotiation going on between insurance company, provider. How's it work?
Yeah, so basically what it would do, it would allow insurers and providers to negotiate. There'd be a set rate for these surprise bills. And when this would happen, the bill would be paid if indeed the individual, you know, did everything. It was, you know, in network, no fault of their own. And it would resolve on the back end and the bill would get paid.
I know that, as we said, that there are several states that have already enacted legislation, and I don't remember which state it is, but one of the things that has been proposed is that these providers would be paid 150% rate of Medicare, which the providers don't like at all because they say that Medicare rates are artificially low. What do you think about that? Is that something that's part of the Pennsylvania proposal?
Yeah, so I think that there's been a lot of back and forth about what that rate would be. I think, you know, as consumer advocates, we're really concerned about how do you just keep the individual and their family out of the middle, right? So, you know, we want to see these protections enforced. You know, we want to make sure that reimbursement rates are adequate. But at the end of the day, the current system's broken. And I think, you know, what we know and what we see is, if someone ends up with a surprise medical bill, they're worried about affording care, they just stop going to get care because they think, well, maybe my insurance isn't going to cover it. And then, you know, folks get sicker, the health crisis escalates, and then it costs the system more for everyone. Mm.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. You can see some of the shows that we're working on, such as the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, Poverty While Working, and Cyber Charter Schools. There's been a lot of controversy about that. The funding for cyber charter schools and the performance of cyber charter schools. We'll be talking about that coming up in the next few weeks. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about surprise medical bills and legislation proposals out there to try to keep them out of the hands of consumers anyway, keep consumers from being surprised with their medical bills. Our guest today, Lynn Quincy, director of the Healthcare Value Hub, Antoinette Krause, founding director of the Pennsylvania Health Access Network, and Jim Pullen, who just told his story of getting a surprise medical bill and was forced to go into bankruptcy after that medical bill came due. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Brittany in Dover. Brittany, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to thank you for covering this topic. We just went through the very same situation. Didn't lead to bankruptcy, but it did lead to collection calls. My son had a procedure on his eyes to put stents in his tear duct, and the surgeon was covered in network. We checked ahead of time, but the anesthesiologist was not. So we got a surprise bill for over $2,000 that we were not expecting.
$2,000, huh?
Yes.
So you ended up paying it?
We went through my husband's insurance and HR, and they said they were going to take care of it, but we still were getting collection calls. So this whole going behind the scenes and taking care of it without us was not happening, and it really caused a lot of stress.
Hey, Brittany, thank you very much for your call. Lynn, what Brittany just described, and I've actually received a few emails here from listeners as well, an anesthesiologist, and that seems to be an area, not just anesthesiologists, but other specialists, where sometimes there's a subcontractor or someone is involved in a surgery or a procedure, and it turns out that they are not in network, correct?
Correct. There's people who have gone into healthcare claims data, and they've identified what are the most common specialties where these types of surprise bills occur. And it's not surprising that they're kind of the people behind the scenes. It's the labs, it's the anesthesiologists, and it's the emergency room doctors.
Using Jim's story as an example, how, when you're asking the provider whether I guess you have to go and be specific whether everyone involved in the procedure, in the treatment, is in network. Why wouldn't the provider provide that information right up front? Why wouldn't they be in a habit of checking that?
Well, I think there's a host of reasons. Hospitals, many will tell you, they have no control over the network status of the different surgeons and doctors that have privileges and are allowed to practice inside their walls. They shifts might change, and if you maybe they don't even know who the anesthesiologist is who's going to be on duty the day of your surgery. So they do claim that it's very difficult to pull all this together and predict it for the patient, but of course it's impossible for the patient. And I think, as Antoinette says, it really makes a lot more sense to let's just take the consumer completely out of the middle and put some requirements on providers and health plans that they work all of this out, especially if the consumer has done the right thing and they've chosen an in-network facility for their medical care.
One thing I will say that is a positive, anyway, from an observation of mine, and you tell me whether it's a positive or not. I mean, we're talking about this. As I mentioned, there are half dozen states that have already enacted legislation to deal with this. Federal government is dealing with it right now. But even here in Pennsylvania, a number of parties coming together to try to work on the problem, including insurance companies, correct?
They would have to be, they're a stakeholder who would be very invested in what kind of a solution is Pennsylvania looking at.
So, Antoinette, what about that? I mean, there are a number of parties, and it seems like this is a bipartisan effort as well.
Yeah, so in Pennsylvania, it's been completely bipartisan efforts. You know, we've had Republicans and Democrats come together to introduce legislation. You have consumers and insurers working together to push this. Recent polling done by the Healthcare Value Hub shows that 9 out of 10 individuals across Pennsylvania want their lawmakers to address issues that impact affordability, surprise medical bills being one of them. Mm.
And both of you, Lynn and Antoinette, you can weigh in on this. I mentioned the federal legislation. It passed a Senate committee last week and would institute the practice of benchmarking, meaning that insurers would be required to pay for out-of-network services at the median in-network rate. What do the two of you think of that? Lynn, well, let's start with you.
I think it's a lot better than what we have now. The other virtue of a federal solution is that states only regulate a portion of the privately insured market. People who have coverage from larger employers would still not be protected from these types of bills due to new state laws, which, you know, we should still have the state laws, but a federal solution has that added benefit. Mm-hmm. Of even protecting people who get coverage from a large employer.
Antoinette, you support that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to have federal solutions, but at the same time, you know, Pennsylvania knows how to regulate its market, and we don't want to say, oh, well, Pennsylvania doesn't need to do anything now because they're taking care of it at the federal level. I mean, quite frankly, we don't know what's going to happen. You know, there's opportunity right here in Pennsylvania, so while we support federal legislation, we think it's equally important for, you know, our lawmakers in Harrisburg to protect everyday Pennsylvanians from this as well.
And I don't want to get too far off track here, but I do want to bring in an issue that we've heard from political candidates over the years, and that is that talking about ways to try to reduce health care cost by allowing insurance companies to sell over state lines. And, you know, I've heard from the Pennsylvania Insurance Department say, well, that wouldn't work for the most part because, you know, they don't have networks in other states. So is that an issue if, you know, that, and I'm just, again, I don't want to bring another issue into it, but when we're talking about that, I'm always curious about, because on the surface, creating competition sounds like, oh, it would drive prices down or at least control cost. What about it in this case, Lynn?
So I am speaking from the position of having served 5 years as what's called a consumer representative with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And there is not a shred of evidence that shopping across state lines will bring down costs because these markets are too complex and there's too many other factors that are driving up costs in addition to the issue you just mentioned, which is how do you create a network in another state? So we can definitely debunk that claim. Health plans right now, a strong health plan will cover services that are needed in another state on an emergency basis, or maybe the center of excellence is located in the other state, or maybe they have a telemedicine benefit and you're a rural person and the person you're consulting with over the phone is located in another state. So we'll need provisions to ensure that your coverage extends to care that might take place in another state. I mean, we need that. But this separate issue of will it hold down costs, we can ignore that claim. Mm.
And when you say a strong health plan, what do you mean? How would you describe a strong health plan?
A strong health plan would have the level of protection that consumers believe they signed up for. It's very difficult for consumers to navigate all the variation that exists there out in the private health insurance market. And to everyone, they want affordable premiums, but they also want coverage that is protective, and they don't want to be surprised. So a strong health plan doesn't have surprising cost-sharing provisions. It doesn't have surprising gaps in the network of providers. It includes high-quality providers in the plan. It's the kind of coverage that everybody wishes they could just easily access, and they deserve.
But at the same time, isn't that more expensive?
Well, it is more expensive than compared to a narrow network of providers that maybe aren't very efficient, but and very high cost-sharing. But the main reason we have high healthcare costs in this country has nothing to do with any of those features. Economists have deconstructed why do medical costs go up so much year over year, and the reason is that our unit prices are going up so much year over year. The price of a drug, an MRI, an emergency room visit. So why harm consumers when the solution really lies at getting control over those unit prices?
So, Antoinette, in the meantime, and I don't know where the legislation stands here in Pennsylvania, but if someone does receive a surprise medical bill, what options do they have?
Yeah, so it's very confusing. And so we encourage folks to contact the Pennsylvania Insurance Department, and they can, you know, file a grievance there. Folks can also call us. We run a statewide helpline, and they can call us at 877-570-3642. Again, 877-570-3642, and we can help folks kind of sort out what their options might be, figure out if indeed it is a surprise medical bill.
All right. When you say their options, what options do they have?
Yeah, so there's very few options in Pennsylvania for folks.
Okay, so let me just get this straight. You said it's confusing. I just want to get this straight. You said it's confusing and they have few options.
Yeah, sometimes you can work it out. You know, in emergency situations, there are some limited protections in Pennsylvania. So, you know, if you're in an emergency situation and you get surprise bills, you know, there's a bunch of hoops you can go through to try and get that remediated. It's very confusing, so we can help walk folks through that process. And sometimes, not every time, and again, this is why we need legislation, sometimes the provider will help work it out on the back end. Or, you know, Jim's an excellent case, right? They were able to, you know, balance bill it to reduce the harm to the consumer. So it's not a perfect solution. And again, it's very limited, and that's why we need legislation. But folks should, you know, try and figure out what bucket they might fall in and what options they have.
So,
and if all else fails, they should definitely contact their legislators to say, you know, we need this in Pennsylvania.
I wonder whether legislators have been contacted about this. Again, I get the sense that many people, when they get the bill, just pay it. That they don't see what, I mean, yeah, they're surprised. They're probably angry about it, wondering how they were going to afford it. If it gets to a point where they're getting collection calls and that kind of thing, it is definitely stressful. But I get the sense that many people just pay it, right?
Yeah, and so polling that Alterum did, that Lynn helped spearhead, shows that 60% of folks in Pennsylvania ended up paying the bill. And I think what's also confusing, people don't realize, right, that it's a surprise medical bill. A lot of folks think it's my fault, right? They don't realize that, you know, they're not at fault, right? They did all of their homework. So I think it's complicated. Folks don't know where to turn. Folks pay the bill. They put it under their mattress and hope it goes away, right? So, you know, we encourage folks to come forward and share those experiences, and that, you know, you're not alone if you experience something like this.
Well, we have on the phone now Steve, who is an anesthesiologist. Steve, am I right? You're an anesthesiologist?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so you understand, you're very familiar with the issue.
Yes, I am. I've been an anesthesiologist. I worked for 15 years in a healthcare system south of you a little bit that was using a large group of anesthesiologists exclusively. They had an exclusive contract with them. They knew very well that they were what they call balanced billing on top of what the standard fees were that the insurance company were paying for the service. And so that every patient was getting a bill and every patient was going to collections. And if they didn't go to pay through collections, they would often be sent to a legal process that they'd have to go through, basically being sued for the money. I thought this was outrageous. After a while, I just quit. I mean, I got out of the business. I did something else now. Because I think it's terribly unfair for what patients are going through. It's with radiologists, emergency physicians, pathologists in labs, these specialties that can basically hide behind not being seen. The patients never see them a lot of times. And Then they get a big bill from the, anesthesia associates or whatever sort of company. And in the healthcare system, very well knows what's going on. They often have exclusive contracts because they say it's easier for their scheduling and stuff like that. And they play this game, and they've been playing this game for a long time.
Well, then what should a patient ask? What questions should a patient ask?
They should ask to talk to the anesthesiologist and ask the surgeon if the anesthesiologist is going to balance bone, because the surgeons usually know, too. I mean, there's no reason that the surgeon doesn't know that the anesthesiologist is balance boning their patients, because their patients feed back to them all the time, because they have to see them after the surgery, and they usually complain about it.
Yeah. Hey, Steve, thank you very much for your call. When I hear that, Lynn, I think to myself, own experience, family experience, probably didn't get to talk to the anesthesiologist until my wife was actually on the table ready to go.
That's the most common scenario. Yeah, I'm really grateful for Steve's call. It is common that a whole range of services will be contracted out, and that whole contract could be out of network. Another thing that regulators can look at is when at the point of health plan shopping, be upfront. You know, they know in the network, do you have any ER doctors who are in-network at your in-network facilities?
Mm. Well, I want to thank the three of you for being on the program today. Jim, after hearing this conversation and what you've learned, what have you learned even today?
I have learned that my neighbors, my Americans, are all at risk. They need their legislators to improve this situation.
I want to thank Jim Paulin, Lynn Quincy with Healthcare Value Hub, and Antoinette Krause with the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, a roundup of Supreme Court cases that the recent Supreme Court session, and there were some pretty high-profile cases that they decided. We'll be talking about that. Also, the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. Mike Greenwald, WITF's Mike Greenwald, was there when Apollo 11, the Saturn V rocket, took off from Cape Kennedy, and Mike will be with us tomorrow talking about that experience. Over the past month, there have been several sightings or reports of sharks, even great white sharks, close to shore along the beaches of the East Coast. Sharks attacking humans is rare, but there have been several cases of sharks biting beachgoers this year, and even one fatality in the Bahamas recently. So today we're talking with Dr. Brian Franks, an assistant professor of biology and marine science at the Jacksonville University Marine Science Research Institute. Jacksonville University is a collaborative partner with OSearch, a scientific research and data collecting organization. Dr. Franks, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And Dr. Franks, before we go any further, I should say that you have a Pennsylvania background with Drexel and Villanova, correct?
Yes, sir. Did my undergraduate degree at Villanova, and actually both of my graduate degrees at Drexel University. So I am Pennsylvania, New Jersey, born and bred.
So you went to the Jersey Shore growing up, right?
Yes, sir. Wildwood was where I spent most of my summer.
So I guess I can ask the question this way. What is with all the sightings of sharks off the coast of Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, but especially North Carolina this year?
Yeah, I do think, generally speaking, we're doing a pretty good job of managing our shark populations in the United States. You know, sharks are very critically important for the health of our ecosystems, and with certain species in certain areas, we do seem to be seeing an increase in some populations. But I also think it's more so people at the more people at the shore, more people at the beach, more people in the water results in more sightings. So I think it's a combination of both. And as I said, I think the fact that we're seeing more of them is reflective of some of our management practices with things like the great white shark.
When you say some of the result of some of our practices, I have seen, you know, quotes, and I think even I've seen you quoted as one of the reasons that we have seen more sharks, and maybe even some areas that you don't expect them, is that because the ocean water is healthier, correct? Or in better condition?
That's a difficult one to say. You know, definitely there are certain parameters in our oceans that we are seeing improvements on, and then there's other parameters or parts of the ocean where we're seeing kind of declines or habitat loss and things like that. So I think it's a bit of both when it comes to that. As I said, we have been pretty good at helping to manage certain species, but yet there's still a lot of things that need to be worked on and a lot more to be done to really try and make our oceans healthy and bring them back to what they once were.
Well, one thing that has been getting a lot of attention lately is plastics and trash and garbage and all that pollutants in the ocean, and so we know that is not a good situation. So what is OSearch?
So OSearch is, as you mentioned, a data-driven organization that allows, it kind of has a three-part mission. One of them is education, and that's education from the, you know, primary school level all the way up to the university level, kind of outreach and bringing science to the public and, you know, open sourcing our data through the Shark Tracker website and allowing the general public to follow the sharks along with us. And then the part where I come in the most, and that's enabling scientists to conduct research on these large animals that, you know, aren't always as easy to access as some of the other species that we would like to study. So we have this, OSearch has this collaborative team of scientists that work together on each of the expeditions that are trying to study as many things as possible to fully understand the biology of these species. And currently right now there's a major focus on the great white shark in the Northwest Atlantic, which is the east coast of the United States.
All right, so let's talk about that. What is the White Shark Project?
So ultimately we're trying to understand the population here, and we're trying to develop a full picture of this population, everything from the health of the population to the movements and migration of the population to the feeding and kind of diet habits, the reproductive biology of the species, and even in some cases looking at things like the microbiological community that lives on the skin and in the mouths of these animals. So it really is kind of a holistic approach. By bringing together these big teams of scientists, you know, we have about 17 different research projects being conducted on these sharks that we're catching aboard the OSearch ship. You know, we're collecting samples that then get distributed to scientists from over 25 different institutions around the country and around the world.
So the information that you collect, how is that information used? What are you looking for?
Ultimately, as I said, you know, part of it is just simply understanding the kind of just innate drive for understanding these species, but then also, and probably more importantly in today's day and age, a better understanding allows you to better manage these species and allows you to better understand how they fit into the ecosystem and how, not just along the east coast of the United States, but how in all of our world's oceans we can manage these species back to what I would consider abundance, back to healthy populations, which again would lead to a healthy ocean, as these sharks are top predators in the ecosystems in which they live. they play a very critical role as kind of the lions or the wolves of that ecosystem, where they tend to keep things in balance. So they're a very important part of these ecosystems. And if we can understand them and understand the biology and ecology of the species, we can enact our best management practices in order to ensure that abundant ocean.
So, you know, I have to admit that I was a little bit surprised of how you actually tag the sharks. Can you explain that or describe that that process, how you actually do it?
Sure. So the sharks are captured, and we try to make our kind of scientific process as efficient and move as quickly as possible. You know, we want to have our hands on these animals as little as possible and get them back out into the ocean. So, and that's one of the advantages to the OSIRT ship, is it does allow a team of scientists to work on the animal, collecting some samples that are difficult to collect in other kind of methods. And the tags themselves, we do use a few different types of tags. When I say tags, I refer to what we call telemetry, basically learning information about the animal once it's released. And that could be anything from the location of the animal to the water temperature in which it's swimming, the depth at which it's swimming. So we use a few different types of tags for that. Each tag kind of has some advantages and disadvantages. And the tags, depending on which tag type we're talking about, kind of get attached in a few different methods. The one that's mostly associated with the shark tracker, that's referred to as what we call a spot tag. That tag actually gets attached to the fin of the shark. And then every time the shark comes near the surface and that tag breaks the surface of the water, we hopefully get a location on that animal. A big advantage to those tags is we can get about 5 years, in some cases 6 years, of battery life out of the tag, and they give us pretty accurate locations. As long as the animal surfaces, you know, for a decent amount of time, we'll get a pretty accurate location of where that animal is. Now, of course, when I say pretty accurate, there are some error in that calculation because of the tag technology, the satellite technology, that sort of thing. But those are the tags that are associated mostly with the locations that you see on the tracker. And, you know, a shark like Mary Lee, who stopped giving us locations last summer, she had her tag working for about 6 years. So she gave us a tremendous data set to work with.
Yeah, I think it's cool that all of them have names, or have been given names. Reason I said I was a little bit surprised is that because you actually pull each animal, each shark, out of the water onto the boat individually and do the research, do the tagging and all that. Okay, and by the way, before I go any further, I got to tell you about this. I got to tell you, the listener, about this, because this is really cool. The shark tracker. It's on the OSIRT website, but we have a link on our website, WITF.org, where you can go to it and actually click on, well, there's a little icon for the sharks that are being tracked, and you can see where they've gone, how long, when they've pinged. It is really fascinating, and I encourage you to do that. I think that you really would enjoy that. All right, but I got to ask you, Dr. Franks, about there are a couple sharks in particular I got to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Costa.
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about Miss Costa.
Yeah. So she was a white shark that was tagged off of Nantucket about 3 years ago now. And Miss Costa is a shark. I think she was about 12 and a half feet when she was tagged. You know, so she is a shark that if she's not reached maturity, she's close to it. And she's given us a great data set over the last few years. You know, what we've found with these sharks is that, you know, they tend to act a bit like snowbirds, and that, you know, by about this time of year, midsummer, these sharks are up in northern latitudes. They're up in the northeastern United States or even up into Canada. And then in late fall, early winter, as the waters begin to cool up north, they make a migration. It's a pretty direct migration. They're not kind of dilly-dallying. It's a pretty rapid migration, relatively speaking, down south, where They spend most of the winter months down here in the southeastern United States and even into the Gulf of Mexico. And then they kind of repeat this pattern. Now, there is some variation in that, which we're trying to understand based on the life stage of the animal, the gender or the sex of the animal, whether it's a male or a female. But Miss Costa, which is the one animal you asked about, she's about a 12.5, well, she's larger than a 12.5 foot female now. And she's done this repeated migration, and she is one that actually multiple years has gone into the Gulf of Mexico. So not all of the white sharks tend to loop around the Keys and up into the Gulf of Mexico, but she's one that every winter seems to do that. And just about a week or two ago, I believe we got our last ping from her, and she is making her way back north again. My guess is, just based on the fact that the last few summers and early fall she's been back off the coast of Massachusetts, that's kind of going to be where she ends up again, probably in the next month or two.
Well, the reason I ask about her is because she had gone from the coast of New England all the way into the Gulf of Mexico, that she had traveled 14,000 miles. And I don't know, is that unusual? That seems like an awful long distance for a shark to travel.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's really not. You know, you look at, so as I mentioned, Miss Costa has had her tag on for about 3 years. And as you said, total kind of distance traveled of 14,000 miles. And, you know, because they're making this fairly long migration multiple times a year, kind of migrating south in the early winter and then migrating back north in the summer, it ends up, you know, being quite a travel distance. You know, if you look at some of the animals like Mary Lee, like Lydia, Catherine, these are all large female sharks that had their tags on for about 6 years. I think a few of those total distance traveled over the six-year period was over 40,000 miles, which, you know, it tells you that it's not odd to see a white shark travel that much. And again, what they're doing is they're seeking out, you know, the best areas for feeding and mating and the best water temperature for them, that sort of thing.
What about climate change? Will we be seeing white sharks even farther north?
It's a very interesting question. You know, there have been a couple of studies that have started to come out recently with some other bony fish, and even one on a coastal shark species that seems to show that we are starting to see maybe some range shifts, where we're seeing the species range move or shift slightly north. And one of the potential kind of reasons behind that would be warming seawaters. It will be very interesting to see. It's something that, you know, I'm very keen to kind of try and tease out of our data sets. But, you know, you do need a pretty long-term data set in order to document kind of a shifting range like that. So, you know, we do, one of the things that OSearch did do last year was we did an expedition to Nova Scotia, Canada, and were able to catch and put transmitters on white sharks up in Canada. And what we're seeming to see is that there's some sharks that seem to summer in kind of the northeastern United States, and there's others that seem to summer off the coast of Nova Scotia and maybe even Newfoundland, kind of the Atlantic provinces of Canada. And likely because both areas, you know, definitely have abundant food for them during that time of the year. Now, whether we see them shift even further north from that, that's yet to be seen, but definitely an interesting question.
We only have about 30 seconds left. Dr. Franks, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. And I'm sure for many people heading to the shore, heading to the beach this summer, question is, do they have anything to be concerned about with sharks?
As I always say, I don't know necessarily that you should be afraid, but you should definitely be aware, be cautious, you know, be aware of your surroundings. You know, if I go for a hike in a forest, I'm going to be aware of things like snakes and bears and things like that. And just as similar, You know, when you enter the ocean, you know, you need to be aware of things like jellyfish and sharks and all of those. But, you know, I don't know that fear or being afraid of them is necessary, but people should definitely practice caution.
Dr. Brian Franks, Assistant Professor of Biology and Marine Science at the Jacksonville University Marine Science Research Institute, and they partner with OSearch. And again, you can see the shark tracker on our website, WITF.org. Dr. Franks, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.